on standing on the shoulders of giants. I am I'm particularly excited today. I'm excited for the whole summer because we get to introduce you to people who have changed my life and changed our lives. And so today, Sandra gets to talk about one of our heroes and one of the heroes in my life. And honestly, after Sandra, this lady is my only other female hero in my life. So Johnny Erickson Tata is our person for today. And would you welcome Sandra as she leads us?
Okay, good evening. It's great to see all you guys here today. As you could tell, I brought Johnny and friends to you, basically. You see all the beautiful things, and Johnny actually, let me see, I think I have it written down. Oh, well, I think she wrote over 40 books, and she's painted amazing things. These are
maybe over 70 books.
Yes. I brought a couple that we have at our house, the devotionals, that small book and this one. And then you can see all her paintings. This one in particular I will share later about. How many of you have never heard of Johnny Erickson Tata? Raise your hand. Like, this is the first time you've heard of this lady. 1%. 2%. Okay, Michael, and what's your name? Curtis? Ernest. What's your name? James. Oh, you heard of her since Jane. You never heard about her, Willie? Okay. How many of you have never read one of her books? Raise your hand. Okay, a few of you. Okay. Well, see guys, James, look at me. These pictures are amazing to paint that. Could you do that? Could you paint like that? Pictures like that? They're pretty amazing, right? I mean, it would be really amazing if someone took their hand and painted all this, right? But you know the amazing thing is? She can't use her hands. So how did she do it?
Without hands.
I wasn't going to say that. Thank you.
She puts the paintbrush in her pen in her mouth, and she did all these with her mouth.
I knew it.
Is that amazing, Ernest? What one of you... Yeah, Michael? What? Did you have a question? I thought you kind of went like this.
Without hands, I always speak.
Okay. Would one of you like to come and try to put a pen in your mouth and write something for me? Just four letters. Would someone like to do that? Joe, would you like to do that? Okay, Doug. Sorry, the pen's not clean because it's just, I took it off the chalkboard. I would give you a new one, but sorry. Okay, now I would like you to write J-O-N-I. Could you put that in your mouth? I'll hold it for you. Okay, I'll hold it for you. Could you do that? J-O-N-I. Sweet. Big. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Woohoo! You need some encouragement.
Mm.
get good eye, not just a line, huh? Top and bottom, too. Johnny would be proud. Is that good, nice, guys? Okay. That, now, do you have greater appreciation of that? I mean, it's good, but, you know. Anyways. That is, hey, that's pretty straight, duh. I mean, it's like, it's even. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, so the public side of Johnny, most of you are familiar with. Johnny and Friends, her artwork. So I would say that, one, she is an author. She has written, like Arthur said, or contributed to over 70 books. Two, you could say she's an artist. Not only with her artwork, but also she's a singer. She has a beautiful voice, and she's, you know, made a lot of CDs. And three, she's an ambassador. She is the ambassador, especially for people affected with disabilities. And the whole Johnny and Friends has a whole ministry. And next week, we're going to a family retreat. And how many family retreats are there now? All over the world. Jenny last year went to China. Nathaniel went to Romania. We're going to Murrieta Hot Springs. There's like several all over the United States. So she has a family retreat. She has Wheels for the World, of which anyone wearing, no one's wearing a V for V t-shirt. Okay, we had the Wheels for the World where our church alone raised over $73,000 to go into that program to help send wheelchairs all over the world. She has a radio show. You should go on her website, johnnyandfriends.org. So that is all accessible to all of us. But I was going to say the things that I'm going to share today, and I'll split kind of the time in half. The first half, I'm going to share just her life story through her books, because no one could say it better than Johnny. And then the second half, I'm going to talk about how we got to know her and what I have learned from her, from my own personal relationship with her. Okay? So the first half, I think I could tell you about it, but I think I'd rather it come from her lips or her words. So I'm going to read some of the excerpts from her book. Okay, so just listen. She's a great author. Okay, Johnny was born on October 15th, 1949. So how old is she?
1949.
Yeah. 64. Okay. She's 64 years old. 63. Accurately 63, because October 15th didn't happen yet. She was born in Baltimore, Maryland, on the East Coast. Kind of near, Baltimore is very close to Washington, D.C., right up there.
That's in the East Coast.
She's the fourth girl of four girls born to her parents. Does anyone know, this is like trivia, does anyone know the names of her sisters in the order? Anyone know? Jenny? The oldest? Second? That's number Jay. Kathy. And then Johnny. And anyone know why she was named Johnny? What's the name of her father? Do you know, Clara? What? Yeah. He wanted a boy, and so he named her Johnny, because if she was a boy, I guess his name would have been John. And so her dad's name is John, and her mother's name is... Anyone know? Jenny? Lindy, right. Okay, so there's these three books that, I think there was another one, something about further, something, a step further. There's like four books that really tell her life story. But if you've never read, especially this one, The God I Love, you should read it. this is, I read it one time, then I read it to the kids one time, and it's just an amazing book. So in this book, she first starts talking about her childhood. And Angela, I'm going to have write down the different phases of her life as I talk about them. So the first one is her childhood. See that little piece of paper? Okay. So, she had a wonderful childhood. She lived in Maryland. They would go camping. They were very outdoorsy. She rode horses. Her dad was an artist. That's where she got her artistic skill from, is from her dad. So the book opens, they're on the beach. And maybe I'm going to call Arthur up to read this one poem that to open up our time. And her dad was a storyteller. They would be at a campfire. The girls would be sitting there in front of the fire. And he would be telling them stories about his adventures on sea and the sailors. And they would be getting all scared. And it would just be a wonderful time, wonderful memory in front of the campfire. But anyways, she said that, you know, at this point, her dad just broke into this poem. So why don't you read that poem for us?
This is one Coach
likes. I know. That's why I wanted to start with that, too.
Sunset, an evening star, and one clear call for me. And may there be no morning at the bar of the bar when I put out to sea. But such a tide as moving seems asleep, too full for sound and foam, when that which drew from out the boundless deep turns again home. Twilight, an evening bell, and after that, the dark. And may there be no sadness of farewell when I embark. For though from our bourne of time and place, the flood may bear me far, I hope to see my pilot face to face when I have crossed the bar.
No one ever broke the silence that followed one of my father's poems. We simply kept listening while the line settled in, the way you listen to a retreating sheet of surf before the next heavy wave crashed down. I didn't understand the poem, except for the part about seeing the pilot. I surmised that was God, but my heart nearly twisted in half to think that my father loved a poem about dying. I remember reaching for Kathy's hand. I knew she would understand my fear. We shared a bed together back home, often after Daddy finished telling a bedtime story and we heard him walk down the stairs. We lay in the dark, listening to our breathing. I reached for her hand once then and murmured, "What if something awful happens?" I wanted to add to Daddy, but couldn't choke out the words. "I know what you mean," my sister whispered back. "I know what you mean about Dad." Well, also, her dad was a lot older than when he gave birth to her. She held my hand then, and she held it now, too, in the dancing shadows formed by the fire. Daddy closed the poem with the same beautiful hymn we sung the night before. My sisters and I crescendoed on the line, "Some poor fainting, struggling seamen, you may rescue, you may save." Once again, all felt safe. Surely my father rescued poor, fainting, struggling seamen, if not on the Sargasso Sea, then for certain during his merchant marine days, yet never did I dream then that in the not-too-distant future, I would be the poor, struggling, fainting one, going down for the third time, drowning in waves of grief, higher than any surf, more terrifying than any Dutchman's curse, and even Daddy wouldn't be able to help. So that's how she opens her book, telling about her childhood. And then she goes on to say, just like, this is the thing I love about Johnny. You read her books, she tells us things I don't even think you would tell your best friend. You know, she is so real. So she continues to say that they, about her childhood, their vacations, and one time she took a trip with her sisters. And in those days, when you get in the car, you don't have to wear seat belts. Like all six of them pile into a car, and the back seat is like a sofa. You know, they just as many people as you could squeeze in, you do. And so she's taking this road trip, and they drove all the way from Maryland all the way to Arizona on the Grand Canyon, and they're driving back through Colorado. And she tells this story. This is just to tell you how real she is. Several days, hundreds of miles, and dozens of landscapes later, we reach western Maryland, pulling into a gas station by the Cumberland Gap. We weren't far from home, and it felt good to take a break. Since this would be the last time we would see real scenery, I took my purple rabbit off the ledge of the back seat to walk him around and show him the rivers and steep hills. I think she's about, you know, maybe in her elementary years. "Now, I realize this isn't like the Rockies," I whispered in his ear, "but you have to remember these sights so we can tell the others back home." I was thinking of Kathy's stuffed animals, or maybe I just wanted to hold on to something that had been there with me, something that had experienced the same enchantment I had and could somehow remind me of it. As I meandered back to the car, I encountered Linda, her oldest sister, leaning on the trunk, drinking a bottle of pop. "Are you still talking to that idiotic rabbit?" she said. She took another swig, wiped her mouth, then set her bottle down. "Here, let me have that thing." Before I knew it, Linda grabbed the stuffed animal out of my hand, then she drew back her arm and smashed her fist into his plastic face. Horrified, I stood speechless. As I watched pieces of plastic fall to the ground, I saw the huge crack in my rabbit's smile and eyes. I lost it. I rushed at my sister with both fists, pounding and swinging at any part of her body I could reach. I cursed and kicked as hot tears spilled down my cheeks. Linda was 16, and she could easily hold me at a distance. "Hee hee," she kept laughing. "Daddy, Mommy," our sister screamed. "Linda and Johnny are fighting." My father and mother came running. "Cut it out, you two," Daddy yelled, but I kept trying to kick Linda. "I said, cut it out," Daddy insisted, this time louder in his gruff, wrestling voice. He reached down and pulled me away by my beaded Indian belt. I heaved great sobs as I tried to tell him what Linda had done to my rabbit. He picked up the tired old stuffed animal, ran his hand over its damaged face. My parents made Linda sit in the back seat and told her she was not to make a sound until we were home. I was made to sit in the front in between my parents. I cradled my damaged rabbit, sniffed back tears all the way to Baltimore. Embittered, I heard Linda muffle a giggle in the back, as if things were normal. "Somebody should smash her in the face," I told myself. And so after I read this to the kids, I emailed Johnny. I said, "Johnny, the kids were horrified when they heard the story about the stuffed animal because, you know, our stuffed animals in our house talk too. Remember Snowy?" And so, and sometimes I'm mean to Snowy. We're on trips, and I take Snowy, and I put him in the electric window, and I push it up until his head's sticking out. But anyways, the kids get really mad at me, too. But the Johnny wrote back to me, "And yes, I was heartbroken when my purple rabbit got his little plastic face smashed in. Linda still laughs about that. And honestly, now, so do I, Johnny." She wrote back about that story. But so Johnny is really real when she tells about her life and her childhood. And this is another thing that, as I'm looking at the time, I'm not going to be able to get through many of the stories. You're going to have to read it yourself. So anyways, maybe I won't be able to read this whole thing, but to, you know, when she tells her childhood, she tells it starkingly real. And she tells these funny little stories about getting in fights with her sister. But she also tells about things about her family that maybe other people would not even mention. So this one part, which I'm not able to read, and you're going to have to read it yourself, but I'll just kind of recap it, is the part when she was talking about her Aunt Thelma, Miss Thelma. So she says this. Well, this is the way it starts. She goes, "On the way home, I asked Kathy, Is Miss Thelma an aunt once removed, or a great aunt, or what? You mean you don't know? Kathy asked a little surprised. No. Who is she? My sister gave me a look that said, I don't know if I should tell you, then dropped the bomb. She's Daddy's first wife. See, things like that, you know, you might not tell the whole public, but what happened was her father married Miss Thelma. But they married, they got to know each other in church, they hung around at, like, you know, the barbecues and the potlucks and everything. They became friends, and so everyone teased them, oh, John, you should marry Thelma, and oh, you guys look like friends and everything. And so they thought, okay, we're friends, you know, we should just get married. That seems like the next likely step to do. And so they got married, but the truth was they never really loved each other. You know, it was just very platonic, and so he married Thelma. They were not able to have children, and I guess it came to the point where they realized that they really didn't love each other, and so they had a mutual parting of ways. But in the meantime, John Erickson said, you know, I will take care of Thelma, even whatever happens to me. So then later on, he met Lindy, who was, I think, something like 14 years younger than him, and then they got married, and they had the four girls. But then what happened to Johnny is that they left the church where, you know, John and Thelma were part of, and they never, even though John's family was still very active in that church, and Johnny always wondered why don't we ever go to the, you know, whatever church? But they've been going to a new church because, you know, why? Because the whole dynamic after that changed, and so, you know, she always had the stigma, like, well, why aren't we accepted in this church? And then they went to a new church. And who is Miss Thelma that we always, you know, visit and take care of? But she kind of lives, you know, little ways off the ranch. But, you know, it seems like she's some aunt or something. And then later on, as the story goes, that Miss Thelma passed away. And John, her dad, says, oh, Miss Thelma always wanted you to have this, and gave her the engagement ring that, you know, that was Miss Thelma's when she was married. So it was kind of like one of those things. But I also want to tell that story to you, because we look at Johnny and it's like, wow, look at the amazing thing that she does. But, you know, she also has, I think that's why I wanted Dada to write. I mean, actually he wrote it neater than I thought, but all of us have a crooked name. You know, no one's perfect. That's why we're all in need of redemption. And Johnny is no different. You know, she has things that she struggles with, and she has a crooked name. And for those of us that don't want to admit that we have skeletons in our family closet and things like that, that's like, why? All of us do. You know, all of us come from broken families, things that we rather not be part of who we are, but it is, you know. So anyways, that's part of her childhood. And then we all know, on July 30th, 1967, something traumatic happened to Johnny. Do you know, Jane? On July 30th, 1967, she was a senior in high school. Some of you are going to be seniors, 17 years old. How many of you are 17 years old? Okay. Austin, if this happened to you, you're active, you're ready for college, you know, you're kind of at the prime of your life in a certain way. But at 17-year-old, she goes to the beach with some of her friends at the Chesapeake Bay. She takes a dive into shallow water, and she breaks her neck. And if you watch, actually, Angela and I and Daniel watched the movie Johnny this week to kind of get ready for this talk. It's shocking. It's messy. It's ugly, you know, what happened. And then she was rushed to the hospital, and then from that on, time on, her life totally changed. She couldn't use her arms and legs. She said that she felt like when they pulled her out of the water, she goes, how come my arms feel like they're tied against my body? And yet when she looked, her arms were draped around her sister, because basically she could try to move her arms, but they wouldn't move. And then she went from this vibrant teenage girl ready for college, riding horseback, horses and going horseback riding and all, and all of a sudden she is in the hospital. And the kids, every time this happens, they left the room. because when they were in the surgery room, first they shaved off her hair. She goes, what are you doing to my hair? Why are you shaving my hair? And then they start bringing out the equipment, like drills and all. As soon as Daniel and Angela see the drill, they run out of the kitchen. And then they flash to another scene. I go, hey, guys, you could come back now. And then they come back. And then there was another part where they have to sand down her hip because she was getting bed sores. And they brought out the drill again. The kids go running out again. I go, no, because they couldn't stand to hear the sound of the drilling on her body. And then they come back. But after that point, her life changed, you know, 180 degrees. I mean, from where she was, and all of a sudden, she went to hell, basically. And so this book really covers that point about the accident. And actually, my time is almost halfway done, and I wanted to get to some other parts, but she basically goes to hell, and then it's the journey back from hell. And I think she was in the hospital and that whole thing for about, what, almost 2 years? Or, do you know? I think it was almost like 2 years. And then when she finally got out, but you have to also know this about her. During those 2 years, I mean, a 17-year-old girl in the hospital, she had a boy, well, she kind of had a couple boyfriends, but, you know, all of a sudden, in the movie, it was made clear, too, she had this one guy that she was dating. I think his name was Dick. And then, you know, oh, tell me that you love me. Tell me that you'll never leave me. Just tell me that you love me. I mean, she was lying in the bed, and she was just desperate. And so, of course, at the end, he left her. He just couldn't deal with, he would hitchhike from college to the hospital to try to see her, but it just could not work out. But before then, in her high school years, she went to parties, she had boyfriends, I think it's, this one part of the story is, after she got out of the hospital, there was this one person that made a big difference in her spiritual life, in her life, this guy named Steve Estes. He was younger than her. He was just kind of volunteering at the ranch to be of help, and then he started doing Bible study with her. So he was what is pretty much her spiritual mentor at that point after she got out of the hospital. So anyways, I want to read this one thing about Steve. As Steve shared basic Bible doctrine with us, I began to see the shallowness of my own faith and spirituality. My spiritual up and downs could be charted as easily and accurately as my physical progress. This became something I wanted to overcome, something I wanted to deal with in a positive way. I began to look at the spiritual principles and revolve my life around them for a change. Alone with God, I recalled how I withdrawn from reality and turned my back on Him so often. I confess, Lord, I've been wrong. Wrong to try and shut you out. Forgive me, God. Thank you for this new understanding of your word that Steve has shared. Please forgive me and bring me back to you, back into fellowship with you once more. The Holy Spirit began to convict, then teach me. With each succeeding week, spiritual truth became more real, and I began to see life from God's perspective. I learned that God's Word is a handbook for sensible living. He doesn't give us instruction without reason. I saw, in fact, that God tries to warn us in Scripture. For example, sex before marriage is wrong. There seem to be so many more warnings in the Bible about illicit sex as compared to warnings about other sinful conduct or behavior, such as gossip, envy, lying, and anger. The Bible says of these, resist the devil, James 4:7. Stand and fight and overcome these faults. But as for sexual sin and sensuality, the Bible says, flee, 1 Corinthians 6:18. If I had been obedient and not given in to temptation, I would not have been tormented by longings and desires that now could never be satisfied. They were like an unquenched thirst. No matter how much I shut out reality and lived experiences in fantasy, it could never be the same. The feelings were shadow, substance, and unsatisfying. I had learned some painful lessons from my relationship with Jason. Now I reap the consequences. I was tortured, but not because I had done something ugly and repulsive. On the contrary, physical love is beautiful and exciting. yet God knows how it frustrates and torments without the context of marriage. I was lusting after memories. I know other girls who have cried bitter tears over the same thing. They have found that guilt and remorse over sex outside of marriage can cloud and ruin otherwise happy lives and handicap otherwise successful marriages. But now, with God's help and forgiveness, I repented and put all that behind me. I prayed for His direction and the mental willpower to think His thoughts and not wallow in self-pity and lustful memories and fantasies. I concentrated on the fact that once and for all, I had to forget the past and concentrate on the present, trusting God, claiming the promise of Scripture that God separates our sin from us forever. Psalm 103:12. That's pretty real, right? For her to share, you know, her struggle, and I wanted to share that with you so that if anything, you could take to heart her words. But anyways, after that point and meeting with Steve Estes, and lots and lots and lots and lots of struggle, there's parts where she just said, she's in an air-conditioned room and she just felt like, turn the air condition off, you know, just let me die. I don't want to live anymore. She begged for her friends, bring me razor blades. I can't use my hands. You have to cut my wrist. You know, she was just so tormented. But finally, she turned the corner on that and said, Lord, if I cannot die, teach me how to live. And then I would say, the rest is kind of history in the sense that when she started regaining the willpower to live, then she started painting with her mouth. She became a pretty... At one point, her dad took all her paintings, took them into a room and had an art show, and then her paintings started to sell. Then she spoke at the Billy Graham Crusade, and then she started writing books. They made a movie of her, and then she started becoming famous. So,
later on.
And then, as we continue on in her story, she started the ministry Johnny and Friends, because after her movie, she got so many letters, so many people to respond that she needed help to respond to all these people. She got requests to speak. She became famous, basically. And then that's when, in 1979, she started Johnny and Friends in her house with some people. And this is what I wanted to start sharing also.
Was it America or?
America. In fact, at this point, I think she was in California because I think she went to rehab in California and then she just stayed out in California, right? And so she started Johnny and Friends. And actually, Arthur and I, after her house, she moved into this leased office space with which Arthur and I visited before she built the IDC, you know, the new one that a lot of... How many of you guys have gone to the IDC? Okay, so International Disability Center. Good question, Willie. IDC. So then another thing entered her life. So besides the fact that the friends, she needed people around her to take care of her, she cannot get up in the morning. She lies in bed and she waits for her get-up girls to come and get her up. She hears them start the coffee downstairs and then she says, I can't do this disability thing anymore. I can't do this quad thing anymore. Lord, I don't have a smile for these girls. I don't have a song for these girls. Give me a smile. Give me a song. And she says by the time they get up to her, she's singing. She has a smile. But it's a fight every single day. But I want to mention one person in her life that was there and met her when she spoke at the Billy Graham Crusade. And then this one person who was a nurse, really gave her life to being Johnny's legs, arms, and everything. And that person is Judy Butler. And I always tell the kids, and I said, almost without a Judy, there wouldn't be a Johnny. You know, Judy Butler really dedicated her life to being Johnny's everything. And travels with her, takes care of her, just does everything for Johnny. And that's what I sort of want to say too, is that, like, think Nathan said about adoption. adoption only works and rehumanization only works with community. Because we were meant to have community. And so, likewise, Johnny cannot be Johnny without a community around her. Judy is one of those, but there's also Rainey and a bunch of other ladies that we've met in our dealings with Johnny that are there to travel with her, get her up, do all these things with her, the community around her. But then there's one special other person that entered her life in 1980. One time in 1980, she was at Grace Community Church. She was bored. She was distracted. She was sitting in worship service. And she was just like so out of it. You guys ever have one of those days? You do? Okay. Then she saw this black hair man, a couple pews up. She just started praying for him. Lord, whoever that man is, you know, I pray that he would be close to you. I pray that he would come to know you and blah, 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 blah. And she prayed for this guy, the back of his head. And then after service, they're out in the lobby, mingling in the foyer. And then this guy, this Japanese guy, comes up to her and they start talking. Well, that was the guy she was praying for in the service. And that guy, as the story goes, ends up being Ken Tada, who she eventually marries. Okay?
A Japanese guy.
Are you surprised, Willie?
Not really.
Okay, but if you were surprised, don't worry. I know you were worried about being surprised. Don't worry. If you were surprised, she tells her this one story. And actually, most of these books are Johnny's perspective. This one book is Ken's perspective. And some of you got it from the V for V. You better read it. This book is so good. So anyways, Willie,
yeah.
Listen to this story.
Sure.
They get married. They go on their honeymoon to Hawaii. Okay? And this will be the last story that I'm able to read you. You know, because of our time, and I want to share our own personal thing. Okay. Clothes changed and out on the beach, Ken kicked off his flip-flops, ran both hands through his thatch of thick black hair, clasped them behind his head, yawned and stretched. The tails of his Hawaiian print shirt fluttered in the soft trade wind. He definitely looked Hawaiian now. Every inch the handsome island guy he had spotted in Grace Community Church once upon a time. With Johnny parked on the Waikiki walkway in the sun, Ken walked down to the surf to stick his toes in the water. George, look who it is. It's Johnny. I don't believe this. Johnny glanced up the sidewalk to see a family of three approaching. Did she know them? No, but they knew her. Through the years, she had experienced this time and again. People would recognize her from her books and her movie, and they'll approach her like they were old friends. It was understandable, and for Johnny, no big deal. But this was different. She was on her honeymoon. Ken, evidently delighted with the warmth of the surf, had waded out to his knees. Well, I'll be, said George, reaching for his camera and his ABC Stores Aloha tote bag. I'll get a snapshot. Johnny didn't want her picture taken. Not then, but apparently they couldn't conceive of that or didn't care. Sighing, she made an effort to smile at them and ask their names. Their son in a bright red South Carolina Fighting Gamecocks t-shirt stuck his hands in his pocket and looked away, apparently embarrassed by his parents accosting the stranger in a wheelchair. Oh, honey! The woman in the brightly colored muumuu reached around Johnny's shoulder and pulled her toward her, squeezing her cheek against Johnny's. We're just so thrilled to meet you. We read your book and saw your movie, and my neighbors just aren't going to believe this when we get home. Hold still, George commanded, waving his hand and staring through his camera's viewfinder. And Junior, get in the picture. Please, Johnny protested. I'd rather you didn't. At this, their faces fell. Stunned into momentary silence, they couldn't believe what they were hearing. Not take a picture. You see, Johnny said in a low voice, it's my honeymoon, as if sharing a secret. You're married? The woman, still holding Johnny by the shoulders, pulled back to look at her from arm's length. Why, isn't that wonderful? It's wonderful, isn't it, George? George, still disappointed over not getting a picture, mumbled something. Who is that lucky fellow? Who is the lucky fellow? She looked around for someone who might be Johnny's husband, ignoring the dark Asian man who had approached in his Hawaiian shirt, shorts, and flip-flops. The man and woman who had evidently taken Ken for a Hawaiian tour guide appeared just a little shocked when he stepped behind Johnny's wheelchair and leaned over to give her a warm, affectionate, and very proprietary hug. This is my husband, Johnny said proudly, Ken Tada. As she spoke, it struck her that this was one of the first times she had to introduce him in that way. But suddenly, the little meeting seemed more awkward than ever. Were they expecting someone different? Maybe someone white? Oh, well, yes, hello, the woman hiked her tote bag on her shoulder, extended her hand. Her husband did the same. Pleased to meet you, Mr. Erickson, he said. Finally, they said their farewells, and the family walked on down the beach. They evidently don't approve of me, Ken said, pushing Johnny's chair back toward the hotel. And who cares what they think, Johnny replied. Mr. Erickson, tell me, do I look Swedish? He sounded hurt. I'm sorry, Ken. That's the way people are sometimes. They don't even consider if it's rude or not. She couldn't get around the fact that she had become a recognizable public person. Was Ken ready for that? Ready to be ignored by excited people who wanted a photo opportunity with Johnny, who weren't really interested in him? She felt protected of him, defensive for him. Sometimes the spotlight that people shone on her cast a long shadow over anyone who stood beside her wheelchair. The public aspect of life wouldn't be easy for either of them. For that matter, the private part wouldn't be a piece of cake either. And my time is running out. I was going to share some of that private part of the struggle, but you're going to have to read the book for that because my time has run out of my sharing. But that brings us up to their marriage. So, is there one more? Go ahead and do that one more. So, how did we get to know Johnny and Ken personally? And for that, I want Arthur to share I have to give all the credit to the fact that we know Johnny and Ken so well to Arthur. I take no credit for it whatsoever. Arthur's the one that takes the initiative on these things. So I want you to share how we first met them.
I was driving home from Orange County one day, and I still have an office in Orange County, and actually I was there today at that same office. And what I do when I drive home is either I pray or I listen to Christian radio or something like that. And on the way home, I was listening to the Bible Answer Man, and he had a special interviewee today, and her name was Johnny Erickson Tada. And when I was listening to his interview of her, what struck me was her eternal perspective. And I had never heard anything like it. I'd never heard perspective like that. I had never heard the depth of someone who had been to a school that I've never heard of. And so after that interview, I was pretty much captivated. They were highlighting a book called Heaven, Your Real Home, which was the first Johnny book that I did read, and I commend that one to you too. It's a great one. We've given a lot of them away. Heaven, Your Real Home. And in a way that only Johnny can really do. She gives perspective because she's gone through a school that none of us have gone through. And after that, I went ahead and ordered another book, and I started listening I ordered the interview and listening to it over and over again, and I was just thrown back and blown away. At that time, as a financial planner, what I was doing is I had done client lunches for my clients, and being a Christian financial planner, I want to do things differently. I want to represent Christ. I want to be able to bring clients into an experience of getting to know Jesus somehow, some way. So, one year I had Coach John Wooden speak at my lunch. And then I was thinking, who should I invite this next year? And I thought, you know what? This is a stab in the dark. This would be crazy. But man, wouldn't it be amazing if I had Johnny come and share. And this is when the stock market was taking a big dump. It was just tanking like crazy. And then I was thinking, what if Johnny were to share with my clients a topic called a bigger view of life? A bigger view of life. That all the clients are so in despair over the stock market dropping so much and whatnot. Try telling that to someone who's got to overcome her a disability to be who she is. And if you ever meet her, she's the most alive person you'll ever meet. And so I wrote a letter, and you know, just wrote a letter to them and made an offer and said, you deserve much more, but this is what I can have. And shared my vision of what I was trying to do with my clients. And if she would come, and it's not a venue she normally speaks at, but would she consider coming and sharing of this perspective? So I kind of laid out my vision for it. And sure enough, Judy Butler calls me back one day, and we start to arrange things, and it starts to happen. And then she asks for me a favor. She asks a favor of me and says, hey, you know, you're in the San Gabriel Valley. Would you happen to know of any house that we can kind of borrow or whatever? Because on Johnny's last trip to China, she met with some leaders in China, and leaders of the church, of the Three Self Church in China, and there's going to be 30 of them coming over to come meet with her and visit and spend some time here. And so I, you know, offered to arrange a dinner with them so we can interact, and was able to actually get the house of Timai and Catherine Wang. And so that was the first time we met Johnny. And then after that, one neat thing is that Ken is an avid sports fan, Ken Tata. And so after discovering that, I told him, hey, you know, I know Coach John Wooden. And his eyes just kind of like that. And I said, would you like to meet him? And he's like, I've never met him. Could you do that? I said, I think I can. And so we arranged the very first time John Wooden and Johnny Erickson Tata ever met, and had a dinner out in, by a coach's place, and met, and it was a phenomenal time. You guys have just got to understand, we're in the restaurant, and Coach Wooden is a lot like Johnny's dad. And that poem I just read, and I didn't even know I was going to read it today, after I see her asking me to read it, that's a poem that Coach Wooden recited at that lunch. And then Johnny was in tears because my dad, you know, recites poems like that. You remind me so much of my dad. And then he said, you know, and so what you saw was a special meeting of the greatest coach of all time, who's such a strong Christian, and this lady who's, and so, and you were just a witness to something great. And as they started sharing poems with each other, and then he would start the poem and she would finish the poem, and we were, and you're just like, whoa, I'm in the midst of greatness, you know. And it was a really, really special time. And that was also the spark. Well, we sang hymns in the restaurant, and we're singing hymns together, and that was the spark of a relationship that he later came and joined her for a really big fundraiser at the Ritz-Carlton in Pasadena. That was meant to raise money, to start raising money for the IDC. So that's kind of our starting point. Like I said, wherever greatness is, I got to get near it. And what I heard over the radio was something too amazing as far as perspective, life-changing perspective, that I had to find a way to get close to that. Is that good?
Okay, and thank you, Arthur. That's perfect.
Sure.
And this is a labor of love. I love Johnny. And so when I knew I was going to talk about Johnny, I looked through all my photo albums, and I looked at all my digital pictures, and I put together all the pictures I had with us of Johnny. So I made a little slideshow so you could kind of get the feeling of our relationship with Johnny. So
wait, can we turn off the projector now?
Okay, as we kind of close up our time,
just have a few words that I just want to say, you know, my reflections about my friendship with Johnny and her life. First of all, I just, like I said before, that if you could see from the pictures, we were busy the last 10 years, you know, raising the kids. You could see how small the children were, right? Angelo was like 1 year old. We started doing the things. So I had, like, kids 1, you know, 4, 5, 7. I mean, we were very busy. And it was kind of a stretch to do extra things. But I just, the first thing I want to share is, like, do not do life with a capital L while you're doing life with a small L. Meaning, Arthur kind of pushed us to do these things, and I felt pretty overwhelmed, you know, with the kids and just our life and all the things we have going on. But you know something? Life is always busy. If it's not school, then it's work. If it's not work, it's raising a family. And if you are so busy doing those things and don't do the important things, like ministry, getting to know someone like Johnny and being inspired to go beyond yourself, you're going to miss out. And so the first thing I'm thankful to Arthur is actually that he pushed us to do life, capital L-I-F-E, while we were doing, you know, life, just being busy about the normal things. So make sure that you don't miss your opportunities while you're so busy. I mean, you think you can't even get busier. I mean, a lot of you are very busy, but don't miss your opportunities, because that is your life, you know, and then you're going to miss your opportunities before you know. It doesn't get less busy, you know. So don't miss your opportunities to do life, even though you think you're already at your max. That's the first thing I want to say. And, yeah, actually, that one part, Arthur, on my one birthday, he blindfolded me. And then we got in the car and we were driving somewhere. I didn't know where. It was like, and then we get out and we were at the IDC, right, during the construction. And actually, I felt mad. I mean, I go, Arthur, don't bother Johnny. I mean, she's got so much to do and everything. Why are we bothering her, you know, to be there? But it wasn't a bother. But I felt, you know, that you know, Asian shy side of me is like, don't impose on people. Like, don't bother people. But I'm so glad that he kind of didn't have the same perspective as I did, you know, and he didn't mind doing that. And so he bothered her then, and then my parents came with us, and then we had dinner and went to their house, and they brought me an ice cream cake, and they were just so sweet, and that was very special. And then he bothered her again on my last birthday, and he asked her if yeah, he bothered her then and made her do a video for me. And then he bothered her again by saying, do you have something special for Sandra? And so she sent us this picture, and she said, this is the only one that exists of this picture. Every other copy of it is not in existence. This, the ink part, the ink part is a print. But the color that's painted on is her original. She painted it on with her mouth. So this is like original.
Thank you.
Huh?
That's her print.
And the print? And she wrote this. She's just amazing. I there's very few people as amazing as Johnny, because besides all the amazing things that publicly you know about her, privately she wrote, dear Sandra, happy, happy birthday, dear friend. This birthday deserves a special gift from your husband. It is a copy of one of the earliest pen and ink sketches I've done. Then I took watercolor and tinted the rendering, so part of it is an original. It is the only begotten. In other words, you've got the only one in existence. May joy and gladness be your constant and prevailing disposition as you lean hard on the Lord in this coming year. And for every challenge, may the strength and grace of God be yours. Thank you, dear Sandra, for the many prayers you offer up on my behalf and on behalf of Johnny and friends. Your love and friendship are a treasure. Have a blessed birthday, friend. She's just so amazing. And then So the things I appreciate about her, there's too many to mention, but she's an amazing Christian woman. It's hard to be a Christian woman and a leader and yet have that balance between knowing how to be respectful of the role of men in your life. But she's an amazing Christian woman leader. And she has Ken, her husband. She has Doug Mazza, who's in the head of the ministry, and Billy Burnett, who's like the pastor of the ministry. But she knows how to work with all of them. You know, just especially for you women, she's just amazing how she could not, she's not, you know, a feminist, but she's not like thinking less of herself than she should, but she does her role, but she respects the leadership, and that's pretty amazing. She's joyful and appreciative. We have so many thank you notes from her, because every Christmas we send her grapefruits, and she always loves them, and she would send us a thank you note. So many emails, thank you for coming to visit, you know, just, we have more thank you notes from her than from probably anyone, and yet look how busy she is. You know, that's pretty amazing. She's probably one of the most intelligent women I know. She's always learning, always reading. She sends me books. She sent me this book called Practicing Affirmation. She sent that to me. She sent me the most recent one, Facing Death with Courageous Confidence. She sends me things. Oh, I heard this. I read this. And she's always sending me things. And she's so sharp. But I think the thing that I appreciate most about her that makes her most unique is the way, the only way I can explain it is just like Jesus. Remember the last time I talked about the kenotic hymn, Philippians 2, 5 to 8, how Jesus, even though he was in the form of God, considered equality God, not anything to be grasped, but emptied himself and became in the form of a bondservant. And being in the bondage, he became, you know, to death, even death on the cross and so on, right? It's like God, who's so great, would become so low. And that's his greatness, is that he's so great that he could become so low. And I feel Johnny is the same way. I feel like she's so amazing, right? Just, you know, look at all that she's able to do. But yet she could be so humble at the same time and reveal the things in her closet. She always tells all these stories about, you know, where she got humbled. And she's so vulnerable. Even when we went to the IDC, I mean, I have to get her food. I have to feed her. No, she can't even feed herself. So God made it so that she could become so great and so humble at the same time. And I think if you guys aspire to be great, remember that it's a rubber band that stretches both ways. If you want to be great, get ready to be humbled. There's no such thing as just great without also being lowly. It's got to stretch both ways if you want to do it in the Christ-like manner. And she's able to do that. And that's what makes her so great. No one is like so amazing as her and also so vulnerable, humble, and lowly and needy as her. So then, why did I do this, too? Why did I have Angela write all these things in this color? Well, first I had Dada write it, and like I told you, Johnny has written kind of messily because life is messy. If you want life to be all neat and tidy, it's not going to happen. It's going to be a fake life that you're living. Life is messy. And life and Johnny's life has all these colors in it. You know, it's childhood, family, teenagers, accident, community duty, growing in the Lord, cancer, marriage, Johnny and friends. Yeah, in 2010 she was diagnosed with cancer, and she went through that. This is Johnny. It's all, and actually these are all the colors of the rainbow. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. And all the colors of the rainbow make up light. If you take a prism, you put light through it, it breaks up into all the colors of the rainbow. All these colors of the rainbow make up light. And Johnny shared with us when we visited the IDC that when she paints and she wants to make like the star look like it's glowing, she paints all the colors of the rainbow on top of each other. And then it looks like it's glowing. She just doesn't use white paint. She really uses all the colors of the rainbow. And so I want to say that that's the way life is. Life is all the colors of the rainbow. Cancer, but yet growing. Marriage could be happy, it could be trial, but and Johnny and Friends is a highlight, but yet there was the accident, and this is Johnny. Johnny isn't just all the highlights, it's the lowlights as well. And so she shared this, if you go on her blog, she shared this one quote by Warren Wiersbe. When you and I hurt deeply, what we really need is not an explanation from God, but a revelation of God. We need to see how great God is. We need to recover our lost perspective on life. Things get out of proportion when we are suffering, and it takes a vision of something bigger than ourselves to get life dimensions adjusted again. And that's just what I want to challenge all of us. It's like, is our focus on life right? Maybe we have to zoom out a bit to see life better. If we think we're going through something so difficult that it's just going to kill me, let's say, maybe we're too close to it. Maybe we got to zoom out and see it from God's perspective a little. How many times did Johnny have to zoom out to see life? She was going through a lot of pain. She went through cancer. Even Ken and her, you know, had their issues. I mean, she had to zoom out many times just to see life through God's lenses and not through her own. And I would say that if you want your life to glow and to shine, then accept all the colors of the rainbow in your life. Don't just expect, you know, to go to USC and have amazing days and get straight A's and, oh, well, you know, life is going to be a Trojan. Wow, I can't get better than that. You know, don't expect, you know, Harvey, for you to win every tennis match, and when you lose, you feel like, what happened, you know? Things happen, and life has its ups and downs, and that's the beauty of it. So some of you that are going through hard times, maybe your family's difficult, maybe you're struggling through some teenage issues or whatever, that turn it to the Lord. He's able to take care of those things. And I just want to end with this one email that Johnny shared, and this kind of encaptures. You could just see her love, her life, and her heart in this. This is what she wrote to me when she found out my mom passed away. We wrote her, and you know, we kind of go back and forth. Actually, the day that we first met her is when Arthur's dad passed away. It was pretty crazy that Arthur was having his client lunch the next day, and then his dad passed away the day before. So when my mom passed away, she wrote, "Dear Sandra, I wonder how the weekend has gone with you by your mother's side. And have you thought back on every sweet childhood moment and memory with her? And did she seem young or old lying there? And did she recognize your presence? And now, I wonder if she has passed on into the other side of eternity yet. And if so, what it must be like to step onto heaven's shore. Thank you for being there by her side, like hopeful by the side of pilgrim when they enter the river of death. I pray that the Spirit of Jesus gave you the best and most fitting words and prayers and hymns to offer by your mother's bedside. And I pray for strength from on high to see you through, and your mother through. These must be difficult of all days. Psalm 31:14-15 says, I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hands. You are loved today, Sandra, even if from a distance, Johnny. And another thing I appreciate about Johnny, she's faced death so many times, and she's not afraid of dying. She always goes, well, if God gives me another day, you know, she's not afraid of dying. And some of us, the fear of dying is what keeps us from living, you know. But she's already done that, been past that, and been removed. She's an amazing woman. I hope from my sharing, you could see how a little bit, a glimpse of how amazing saint she is, and how blessed we are to have her. And I hope this talk would inspire you to go read some of her books, and just let her life influence you like it influenced me. Okay, so let's pray. Dear Lord, I just pray that, I ask that for these young people, that they won't have to break their neck to turn to you and to dedicate their life to you and to live fully for you.
But if it takes something drastic, like Johnny said, it's better to be in the wheelchair and to know you and to love you than to be walking. So just help us, Lord, to do what you can to give us all the colors of the rainbow in our life, the high points, low points, in order to make us glow and shine for you so that people could see we're just not nice people. We're just not people that dot our I's and cross our T's, but we are redeemed people, people that have the Spirit of Christ living in us. And I just thank you for Johnny, because she really exemplifies that kind of living and that kind of life. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Feel free to ask more.
Yeah, exactly. If you have any questions.